back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
The freed prisoners appear totally and extremely pale here, as they haven't seen the sunlight for years.
Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners and detainees come home as negotiations to end the war in Gaza continue. For Monday, October 13th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. Our correspondents on the ground give us the latest on the Israel-Hamas peace plan. And the Nobel Prize in Economics was awarded to three men whose findings could reshape the next generation of technological breakthroughs.
New technologies are brought in by disruptive outsiders who are interested in shaking up the status quo. But if they succeed in doing that, they become the status quo.
Also, how Turkey became the go-to place for Westerners seeking a lower-cost hair transplant.
Including my flight over here and then what I'll pay for the hair transplant, I think it was probably close to 50% cheaper.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Around 1,700 Palestinians were released from Israeli prison and returned to Gaza today as part of a ceasefire deal in the war between Israel and Hamas. In return, the remaining 20 hostages still alive after being held in Gaza for more than 2 years were returned to Israel, along with several bodies of hostages. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
The Palestinians returned to Gaza were part of thousands seized by Israeli forces and imprisoned without charges during the war. In the city of Khan Yunis, loved ones cheered at their release. Islam Ahmed, a journalist from northern Gaza who was detained by the Israeli military late last year, spoke with NPR's Anas Baba. It was miserable in prison. We were beaten and humiliated, Ahmed said, noting he lost more than 60 pounds in 10 months. Israel's prison service has defended its treatment of Palestinians, although human rights groups in Israel and abroad have documented serious mistreatment. Around 200 Palestinian prisoners were also released, many who had been serving sentences for serious crimes against Israelis and exiled to other countries. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News.
Major questions remain about the future of Gaza, including whether Hamas will disarm and who will govern the enclave. But after celebrating the first steps of the U.S.-brokered ceasefire deal, President Trump is trying to advance a broader peace in the region. He's calling for a new era of harmony in the Middle East.
All the momentum now is toward a great, glorious, and lasting peace. And our commitment to fulfilling the 20-point plan we developed together will be the crucial foundation for achieving that bright future, and it's being worked on right now as we speak.
Trump spoke during a global summit in Egypt on Gaza's future. Trump urged world leaders to end old feuds and said the Israel-Hamas ceasefire is the first step to peace. About 20% of the U.S. Department of Education's remaining staff received reduction in force, or RIF, notices on Friday. As NPR's Corey Turner reports, that includes nearly everyone inside the department's Office of Special Education.
This office collects and analyzes data and annual reports from states, making sure they're following federal law and serving the nearly 8 million kids with disabilities in the U.S. If staff worry a state has fallen out of compliance, they step in. They even have customer service reps who answer calls directly from parents and families. I spoke with six staffers who received RIF notices. They told me nearly the entire staff had been laid off Friday, except for a few top executives and support staff. One said, quote, "This is decimating the office responsible for safeguarding the rights of infants, toddlers, children, and youth with disabilities." The Education Department did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Corey Turner, NPR News.
U.S. stocks recovered more than half of their sell-off from Friday. The S&P 500 climbed 1.5%. From Washington, you're listening to NPR News. Republican leaders of North Carolina's legislature say they will go ahead with redrawing the state's congressional districts next week to be more favorable for GOP candidates. It's part of President Trump's national gerrymandering effort, which started with a new map in Texas that could help Republicans win five additional seats in Congress there. Voters in California will decide whether to allow a new map there that would allow Democrats to win five seats. Halloween candy is pricier than ever this year, with costs up by more than 20% since 2021. But that's not slowing down American consumers, as NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
Candy prices are up 8% this year alone, according to the National Confectioners Association. That's largely because of a cocoa shortage from West Africa. That area produces the majority of the world's cocoa. It's been deeply affected by climate change, like extreme droughts and rain. That in turn affects big chocolate companies like Hershey, which doubled prices earlier this year. Some consumer advocates are urging Americans to buy non-chocolate treats. That could mean a lot of Jolly Ranchers for trick-or-treaters. Americans are expected to spend nearly $4 billion this year on Halloween candy. That's according to the National Retail Federation. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Cape Verde will play in the World Cup for the first time next year after beating Eswatini 3-0, securing one of the 9 automatic spots for the African continent. It'll be the second smallest country by population to be featured in the World Cup after Iceland in 2018. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It is 6 minutes past the hour. You're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. Now back to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. It's an historic day in the Middle East.
Can we get the documents, please?
That's President Donald Trump speaking today from the Egyptian coastal town of Sharm el-Sheikh. That's where delegations from Israel, Palestinian territories, and mediating countries will kick off the next phase of the ceasefire plan in Gaza.
With God's help, it'll be the new beginning for an entire beautiful Middle East.
However, on the ground in Israel and the Palestinian territories, today was about homecomings. We start in Israel. For Avi Ohana, it's a day he's longed for. In this video posted to social media, you can hear him shouting a celebratory prayer as he greets his son, Yosef, one of the 20 living hostages who were freed from Hamas captivity today. 2 years. 2 years, he screams as he tightly embraces his son. The freed hostages have been taken to hospitals in Israel that have developed an expertise in treating released captives. NPR's Daniel Eshrin reports from central Israel on what the released hostages' first few days of freedom will look like.
Helicopter by helicopter, freed hostages landed to cheering crowds at Rabin Medical Center in Petah Tikva near Tel Aviv. We visited a few days ago as the hospital was preparing to receive them. Dr. Michal Steinman, head of nursing, has cared for other freed hostages a few times before in the war.
Usually I'm telling them, welcome home, and so glad and you're in good hands. You're in good hands. You came home.
5 of the freed hostages have come to this hospital. They're all men in their 20s and 30s, all abducted from a music festival, the site of the single deadliest Hamas attack on October 7th, 2 years ago. They each get new cell phones and ID cards, and each one gets 3 rooms, a living room for visitors, a room for their families, and their own private room.
This is a room of a hostage.
The bathroom is stocked with fancy body lotions and slippers. Their families decorate the room with some of their favorite things. The bed has anti-allergenic sheets.
We ordered them from special cotton because when you came back from hundreds of days of captivity, we learned to understand that there's a lot of skin problems.
The last time hostages were freed was this winter. They'd spent about 500 days in captivity. Freed hostages spoke about being starved by their captors, held in underground tunnels. Today's hostages were freed after more than 700 days in captivity, some very thin. Steinman says they'll work with a nutritionist to slowly increase their appetite.
I think it's a mechanism of the body because you've been starved for so long, you just lost the passion for food.
Besides their physical health, there's also their mental health to look after. The hospital's head social worker, Karen Karina Schwartz, helps families reconnect to their freed relatives after 2 years in Gaza.
Everyone is different. There are people that will come back and tell you everything in 5 minutes. And we meet people that until today don't want to talk about what happened there.
She advises families to be sensitive. She's seen some families ask their freed loved ones too many questions and other families not ask anything.
If he sit in the room and tell you that he's been through difficult thing in captivity and you don't say anything, it's the loudest quiet in the world.
The loudest quiet in the world. They endured the longest stretch of captivity, but have returned knowing they're the last ones, leaving no living hostages behind in Gaza. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Petah Tikva, Israel.
And now to Gaza and the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Crowds filled the streets, welcoming home thousands of Palestinian prisoners and detainees who've been held in Israeli custody. These homecomings are the result of the first phase of a ceasefire agreement. NPR's Anas Baba and Carrie Khan have been reporting all day on the releases there. And a warning to listeners, you will hear the sound of gunshots in this conversation. NPR's Carrie Khan joins us now. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
All right, so the largest number of Palestinian detainees and prisoners released from Israeli prisons were sent back today to Gaza. What can you tell us about that release?
More than 1,700 of the nearly 2,000 detainees were bussed into Gaza today. They are among the thousands that Israel has detained in Gaza following the October 7, 2023 attack on Israel. Israel says they are, quote, unlawful combatants. They've never charged them. And for many of their family members, they've received no information about their whereabouts for up to 2 years. NPR's Anas Baba was in southern Gaza today as the detainees arrived to great cheers and celebratory gunfire. At the Nasser Medical Clinic in Khan Yunis, he described families out in force. There were children holding flowers, and he says the mood was just such an incredible mix of emotions, hugging, and lots of crying.
The freed prisoners appear totally and extremely pale here, as they haven't seen the sunlight for years. They are very weak to walk, actually. It seems also that there are no homes or neighborhoods to return to. This was the news that most of the prisoners cried for.
According to one Israeli human rights prisoners group, there are still more than 1,000 detainees from Gaza still in Israeli custody. So for many waiting at the Nasser Medical Clinic today, they left heartbroken, not finding their loved ones among those released.
You were in the West Bank where hundreds of prisoners from Israel were also freed. And as I understand it, many were prisoners serving life sentences. Who did you talk to today?
Right, that's correct. In Ramallah, a huge crowd greeted a bus of detainees and prisoners released at the city's cultural center. But Israeli troops had warned families of those to be released that there could be no celebrations or Palestinian flags visible, no rejoicing. The crowd dispersed very quickly, and relatives waved me away, saying they were just too afraid to talk. I went to a local hospital, too, where 12 detainees were taken for treatment. And I spoke with one man who was so skinny and frail. He was getting IV fluids and getting tests. He was holding this piece of bread, but he said he really had no desire to eat. I spoke with the ER doctor there who was overseeing the care of the released prisoners, and he said all of them were malnourished and some showed signs of scars, bruising, and healed broken bones. And we asked the Israeli prison officials about allegations of torture, and as they have previously, they denied any mistreatment.
Well, who else were you able to talk to? And were there any prisoners who were expected to be released but weren't?
Of the 250 Palestinians released who are serving these long or life sentences in Israeli prisons, 154 were deported immediately to countries abroad. I spoke to one family in Ramallah who had gone to greet the bus to pick up their son who'd been in an Israeli prison, convicted of murder, and he was in prison for 24 years. He was not on the bus. He was deported to Egypt. And his mother, Fatma Abu Dar, said she was crying from both joy and sadness.
Wallahi alhamdulillah. I wish I hamadat Allah. Alhamdulillah.
She kept thanking God that he was free, but she said she had no words to describe the pain in her heart for not seeing him today. The release of so many prisoners serving life sentences for murder of Israeli citizens has caused a lot of pain in Israel. It's become a common controversy as this is the third large-scale prisoner hostage exchange during the two-year war in Gaza.
NPR's Carrie Khan. Carrie, thanks.
You're welcome.
Devastating floods have left at least 64 people dead in Mexico. NPR's Ada Peralta reports there are still communities cut off from help, and 65 others are reported missing.
The torrential rains were caused by a meteorological confluence. In the Pacific, there were two tropical storms. Then a cold front came in from the north and another low-pressure system moved west to Veracruz. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said residents were warned that rivers would rise.
Pero tener el conocimiento de que iba a tener esta intensidad,
but knowing that it would be this intense, she said, was impossible to predict. At least, she said, it would have been impossible to give ample warning. The rains fell Thursday and Friday. Five states were severely affected. The government estimates that 100,000 homes have been affected. In a town in Veracruz, a river broke its banks, and within 30 minutes, water had almost reached to the roof of the central bus station. One woman caught it on tape and posted it on social media. It shows water rushing through the station with so much force that it dragged cars. From her perch on a rooftop, she sees a man trying to swim against the current. He's fighting for his life, she says. Another video posted online shows a boy shouting for help as he clings to a tree.
Ya está bajando el agua.
The water is receding, a man on a nearby roof tells him.
Resiste un poquito.
Just hold on a little bit longer. President Sheinbaum toured the disaster area over the weekend. She rode on a military pickup across mud-caked roads, surveying businesses and homes that were completely destroyed by floodwaters. She was met with anger and frustration. One man said university students had been missing for 3 days and there's been no help. The president tried to calm him. We're getting started, she tells him. We've been here for 3 days, he says. We've been sleeping out here for 3 days. President Sheinbaum said a whole-of-government rescue effort is on its way. Helicopters are ferrying food, but some roads are still unpassable. Clearing those, she said, is the priority. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. We receive support from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative committed to community and giving back through scholarships, youth programs, Operation Roundup, and more. Lake Country Power, made by the community, for the community. Minnesota Mixtape is our deep dive into the local music scene, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. with host Malachi Coons. We receive support from Itasca Economic Development Corporation, creating and retaining quality jobs in Itasca County through education, research, and connections with businesses. Working to help grow small businesses of all sizes and strengthen our local workforce. Learn more at itascadv.org. The Arrowhead Library System presents They Brought Their Songs, International Folk Music in Minnesota, with musical trio Kaylee, now through November 5th. Find a full list of dates, times, and locations at als.info. Fire in the Village hosts a Creative Crow Club the first Wednesday of each month from 4 to 6 at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Youth can explore their artistic gifts, find their voice, and build a caring community. Kotaska Community Action in Grand Rapids is collecting gently used kids' Halloween costumes now until October 15th. Costumes can be dropped at the former Murphy Elementary building from 9 to 4 weekdays. Northern Exposure to Lifelong Learning welcomes Doug Omen at the Bagley American Legion Wednesday, October 15th at 9:30. Omen will talk about the Barns of Minnesota. The City of Cohasset Parks and Rec Department offers woodsy walks at Tioga every Monday and Thursday at 1:30 p.m., free and open to all. Meet at the Tioga Recreation Area parking lot. Now back to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. The U.S. has sealed a $20 billion rescue package with Argentina to prop up the peso as its reserves run dry. President Javier Milei, a right-wing libertarian and a close Trump ally, will visit the White House tomorrow to seal the deal. Elected nearly 2 years ago on promises to slash spending and rein in triple-digit inflation, Milei initially made headway. But a faltering economy and a string of corruption scandals now threaten both his reform agenda and his grip on power. Natalie Alcoba reports from Buenos Aires.
This wasn't your average book launch. But Javier Milei is not your average president. A leather-clad Argentinian president gave a concert last week to promote his new book, The Construction of the Miracle. Less rock and roll, more libertarian economic philosophy. Belting out rock songs at a packed arena in Buenos Aires, amid a faltering economy, recent local election losses, mounting scandals, and looming midterms, Milei picked this moment to perform songs like this. I'm a liberal. You can't step on me because I'm a capitalist, sang the president in a strained duet. Among the thousands of fans was Maria de los Angeles Lopez, a house cleaner from a small town in the province of Santa Fe. We're from very far away, very far away. We've been traveling since 3 a.m. just to see Milei, she says. We have all of our faith in Javier Milei because we know that things are going to change, even if many people say they won't. Another concert goer, 52-year-old Elva Soria, described her ongoing support of the president as an expression of hope. We bet on him because there wasn't another option, she says. We didn't like the future that we saw. Elected in December 2023 amid an economic crisis, during the campaign, Milei took to wielding a chainsaw to symbolize his plans to slash public spending. His eccentric outsider persona appealed to Argentines tired with a revolving cast of politicians. While he has managed to drive down inflation and balance the books for the first time in over a decade, deep cuts and deregulation have made life tougher for many here. Figures released this month by the National Statistics Agency suggest the average pay is under $700 a month.
We're backing him 100%. We think he's done a fantastic job. He, like us, inherited a mess.
Now President Donald Trump has stepped in. The White House has finalized a $20 billion lifeline with Argentina to prop up the flailing peso, part of a rescue plan for a key political ally in Latin America. U.S. intervention may have propped up the peso for now, but back home, outside Milei's core supporters, many remain deeply skeptical about the president's ability to turn the economy around. That skepticism is visible on the streets. The shrinking turnout at this weekly pensioners' protest outside the National Congress reflects the exhaustion of those struggling just to make ends meet. Yolanda Gutierrez, a widowed pensioner from the northern province of Salta, is visiting the capital and caught the tail end of the demonstration. We're not doing very well, she says, especially pensioners like me. Prices keep going up, but our incomes haven't. Gutierrez says it's not just retirees. She has two sons. Things are tough, she says. Young people really have to struggle. Milei's popularity is at an all-time low, roughly 63 disapproval rating, according to one poll. A survey from polling firm Zuban Cordoba found that most Argentines don't expect conditions to improve anytime soon, a troubling sign for Milei as midterms approach towards the end of this month. And the economic future, uncertain. We have a perverse president, says Eva Marcilio, a 65-year-old retired teacher.
I don't know what world he's living in. He doesn't see what's happening to people. It's very sad. And every day, she says, it gets worse. For NPR News in Buenos Aires, I'm Natalie Alcoba.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Sylvana Clark. In 1971, Clark graduated from high school. Soon after, her parents moved to another state.
They didn't ask where I would be living or if I was going to college. They knew nothing. They didn't give me any money, and they just left.
Clark wanted to continue her education, but she wasn't sure how she would cover the cost. Luckily, her high school drama teacher had just taken a job at a community college and suggested she register there. She had just enough savings to pay for housing and attend classes.
I saved every penny I could and got to college, had a wonderful first semester. I still was very tight on money. I remember not having enough money for toothpaste, and so I just brushed my teeth a long time with water. But anyway, at the end of the first semester, I realized I didn't have enough money for the second semester. I just couldn't make it on my own. So I told my drama teacher, I said, I can't come next semester. I'm going to try to work really, really hard so I can come next year, but I just can't make it again. Well, 2 days later, he comes up to me, and he's always been kind of gruff, and he goes, well, you don't probably really deserve it, but I found out there was a college drama scholarship, and well, you got it, so your next semester is totally paid for. And I was just in shock. I couldn't believe it. And so, you know, the next semester, I got little part-time jobs. I was an Easter bunny at a mall. I worked at the park department, anything I could just to save up money. But about halfway through the semester, I kind of thought, I wonder if that scholarship is renewable. So I went to the financial aid office and I said, hi, I got a drama scholarship. I just want to know, is it renewable for next semester? And she looks and she says, there is no scholarship, but your tuition and room and board was totally paid for. And that's all she would tell me. So I knew that my high school drama teacher, and then my college teacher, he paid for my semester at college. That summer, I got a pretty good job as a camp counselor, and I could save again every penny so I could work my way through college. And because of that, I didn't have to drop out and possibly never come back. I'll never forget that he said I had a scholarship and he paid for my college tuition. And I get teared up just thinking about it.
Sylvana Clark of Alexandria, Virginia. For years after graduating, she stayed in touch with her drama teacher, George Meschke. He died about 15 years ago. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Watermark Arts Center's next Story Slam is Thursday, October 16th at Bemidji Brewing. Music begins at 6 with stories at 7. This month's theme is Scared Stupid. Stories should be 5 minutes or less. Find more information at watermarkartcenter.org. Now it's time for the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. The Bemidji State football team has celebrated homecoming victories with a refreshing dip into Lake Bemidji for decades. The Beavers celebrated 30 years of the lake jump after winning against Northern State University 24-21 for the homecoming game on October 4th. The Bemidji State Alumni and Foundation recently obtained footage of the first ever Beaver homecoming lake jump. It was 41 degrees on October 14, 1995, when the Beavers left the Chet Anderson Stadium and ran into the lake, winning the homecoming game after several losing seasons. BSU Alumni and Foundation Communications Manager Micah Fries says two alumni sent in the footage earlier this summer. He dove into the story as the former sports reporter for the Bemidji Pioneer, tracing the lake jump's origin.
Graduate assistant coach, his name was Frank Hagee. He wanted to inspire the team. It was on a bad losing streak. So he wrote this faux post-game article that said that the Beavers won the game, and in a fit of jubilation that they raced into the lake and went celebrating with a swim in Lake Bemidji. And I think it made waves around campus and kind of circulated around the student body. They actually upset Winona State, the defending conference champions, which was a really great win for the program, let alone one that was on a losing streak and really needed a win. True to form of the faux article, they went in, pads and all, into the lake, and tradition was born from there.
The last few years of Beaver homecoming wins have seen much warmer temperatures, with this year's homecoming temp reaching 85 degrees. Fries thinks football players are more excited about the win than worried about the temperature.
It didn't look very warm, especially, you know, with last week's memory of how nice and warm that was. But I don't think they cared what the temperature was, right? They were so excited to get in that lake.
Bemidji State's homecoming traditions find more than football to honor their present and past student bodies.
We have a lot of really cool alums, probably more than we can give awards to, but we get to give out some awards and kind of recognize the good work that some of our alums are doing every year, which is a really cool opportunity that we get to do.
Fries says planning is already underway for homecoming in 2027, which marks a major milestone.
So 1927 was the first ever homecoming at Bemidji State when the school was 8 years old, and they decided they wanted to start having homecoming. Kind of was popping up around the country, and they decided that it was time. And so we're coming up on 100 years in 2 years now, which we're already planning for and you know, kind of getting the ball rolling on that stuff.
Fries says the alumni leaders in the classroom program is especially meaningful for current students during homecoming.
An opportunity for alums to go into a class of, you know, kind of their career field and kind of speak of their expertise or answer questions that students have. You know, those students who are maybe seeking out, do I want to be in this field? What does it look like? How do I succeed? And so we have alums who give back their time and be involved in that way, and has really benefits students, I think.
With the Bemidji State Honors Gala and alumni in the classroom, alumni and families come back to campus every year, joining current students for homecoming events.
This is the weekend that they circle on their calendars and want to come back, and it's a reunion with their college buddies or you know, other. I know a lot of parents are here with, you know, their parents are the football players, and they're here tailgating. They have a big presence always. So things like that. So every year it's in the thousands.
Bemidji State's Alumni and Foundation recently launched the Regrow Our Roots campaign, a fundraiser to replant some of the hundreds of mature trees that fell in the June 2025 severe storm. The organization offers numerous ways for alumni to reconnect through meetups held throughout the United States as well in the Twin Cities metro.
At least once a year, it feels like. So definitely lots of ways to get involved. And like I said, we make it as easy as possible and hopefully as fun as possible, too.
More information is on their website at bsualumni.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXC.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. From the KAXC News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV. With new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrew Limbong. Technological innovation has led to a steady rise in standards of living for the last two centuries. Three men who study that process were rewarded today with the Nobel Prize in Economics. Their findings could help shape our response to next-generation breakthroughs, like artificial intelligence. NPR's Scott Horsley explains.
To illustrate the dizzying advance of technology over the last 200 years, members of the Nobel Prize Committee held up a slide this morning showing the evolution of the telephone from an antique hardwired desktop model to a sleek modern smartphone. Despite those advances, though, two out of three Econ Prize winners missed their congratulatory phone call this morning from the Nobel Committee.
See, my phone is set in such a way that I can only receive phone calls from people on my contacts list, because otherwise I get junk calls in the middle of class and I, you know, stuff.
That's Joel Mokyr of Northwestern University, who only discovered he'd won the Nobel Prize when he later fired up his computer and found a note of congratulations. Mokyr is an economic historian. He found that innovation doesn't necessarily lead to economic growth, only when it's paired with the know-how to commercialize a new technology and with a society that's open to change. Jan Hassler of the Nobel Committee says that combination has allowed living standards to more than double with each generation, thanks to new medicines, better communication, and more efficient sources of energy.
Over the span of one or two centuries, almost everything has changed. Change, not stagnation, has become the new normal.
But as with telephones, technology that's state-of-the-art one moment can soon be eclipsed by something better. So Mokyr shares the Nobel Prize with two other economists who helped describe that process of creative destruction, Peter Howitt of Brown University and Philippe Aguillon of the College of France. Howitt says it's important to create safety nets for workers who might be displaced by new technology. Otherwise, they're likely to fight it in a way that limits economic growth.
Every new technology that has a great impact creates great losses as well. People have to be compensated. People have to be negotiated with in order to resolve that conflict in a way that allows the technologies to proceed.
Artificial intelligence could be the next big innovation, but Howitt says it's vital to maintain a competitive environment and not allow a handful of superstar firms to short-circuit the next round of innovation.
New technologies are brought in by disruptive outsiders who are interested in shaking up the status quo. But if they succeed in doing that, they become the status quo, and they are very resistant to people that want to do that in turn to them.
Howitt is skeptical about claims that AI will trigger widespread unemployment. He says similar fears about earlier technological advances proved to be unfounded. Still, Howitt and his fellow prize winners did warn of dark clouds on the horizon. Cuts to university research could create potholes in one path to innovation. Aguillon says the Trump administration's protectionist trade policies could also hamper economic growth.
Openness is a driver of growth. Anything that gets in the way of openness is an obstacle to growth.
The winners will split a prize of 11 million Swedish kroner, or about $1.2 million. Aguillon plans to invest his share into research with younger colleagues in further pursuit of creative destruction. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
All right, fellas, let's talk. The choices for men losing their hair are limited. We've got a wig, a comb-over. We could just shave it off. Transplants, too, but they're expensive. Except these days, the procedure is booming in Turkey. We sent reporter Rebecca Rossman to Istanbul to see why.
It could be an art class. There's a canvas, a marker, and someone leaning in carefully to draw. Only here, the canvas isn't paper. It's a scalp. And the artist, Dr. Mehmet Erdogan, no relation to the Turkish president.
Okay, I will draw
according to what I recommend to you.
With his Sharpie, Erdogan sketches neat lines across the head, mapping the spots that could use a little more hair. That head belongs to Justin R., a registered nurse from California. He asked me not to use his last name so that he could discuss a private healthcare issue.
There's a small gap. Maybe you are sometimes obsessed on looking that, or maybe you don't notice that too much, but we will fill those areas.
Notice it when the hair is longer. Yeah.
We are at the Smile Hair Clinic in Istanbul, founded in 2018, and now treats about 5,000 patients a year. A third come from the U.S., the rest mostly from Canada, the U.K., and Australia. Price is a big incentive.
Including my flight over here, and then what I'll pay for the hair transplant, I think it was probably close to 50% cheaper. I want to say it's like $3,400 US.
But for Justin R., it wasn't just numbers on a bill, it was numbers on his head.
Quite frankly, what it boiled down to was I just wanted to get it done, and I don't really care what anybody else thinks.
Justin always thought when the time came, he'd just own it, shave his head, maybe grow a beard. But when push came to shove, he says he wasn't ready. So Dr. Erdogan gets to work. Follicles from the back of the head carefully moved to the front. Patients can feel a slight pressure, maybe a tiny pinch, but it's mostly quiet, methodical work.
It's a very small punch, very, very small punch, so it's not very visible after the operation to the patient. Just small holes, maybe.
But not every picture turns out so pretty. Some clinics have been accused of using unlicensed doctors or leaving the work to their assistants. And then there's the plane ride home, wrapped in bandages for all to see.
I decided, I was like, you know what, I'm gonna do it here in New York. I don't want to go to Turkey.
Comedian Matteo Lane made it part of his 2023 stand-up show, Hair Plugs and Heartache.
I just seen all those pictures of those guys, hundreds of guys with their heads wrapped, swollen like they're the alien from Mars Attacks. But I just want to be ugly at home.
Hair transplants may be having a moment, but it wasn't always this way. What's driving the craze? Experts point to psychology and social media.
Most people worry about hair loss regardless of their actual hair count because the advertising is so strong around it.
That's Glenn Jankowski, a professor of psychology at University College Dublin. He wrote a book called Branding Baldness. Social media, he says, has fueled much of the recent boom.
Like I said, 5 months ago, I flew all the way to Istanbul, Turkey to Smile Hair Clinic, where I got an amazing procedure.
At the Smile Hair Clinic, even the waiting group makes the case. A giant screen loops videos from TikTok and Instagram influencers, showing off their new hairlines like they were born that way. Jankowski, though, says many men choose another option, acceptance.
The head hair that we carry on top of our heads, we think it's really meaningful. It's not that important. It doesn't clog my shower anymore. It doesn't, like, fall into my porridge, as Shakespeare says. Like, there's a beauty and wisdom to it that we are unfortunately losing.
A few months after our first meeting, I called Justin R. to follow up. He tells me he's happy with the results. His hairline looks more youthful, he feels more confident, and he's relieved he was able to save money in the process.
I'm happy I had the option to go to Istanbul, for sure.
Okay, great. I feel like we're going to see a lot less bald heads in the future, just in general.
You might.
And while baldness isn't going extinct, it may be endangered. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Istanbul.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Nearly 3.5 years after the deadliest school shooting in Texas, a school to replace Robb Elementary is opening in the town of Uvalde. The school is called Legacy Elementary, and Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips attended the opening ceremony.
Todas las mañanas que entra por mi ventana el señor sol, doy gracias a Dios por otro día más.
These junior high mariachi performers were students at Robb Elementary in 2022 when a gunman entered their school and shot their teachers and classmates. Now, standing in the library of Uvalde's new school, they sing about thanking God for being able to see the sun through the window for another day. Legacy Elementary is bright, colorful, and full of windows that let in the sun. Behind the students is a wall of windows showcasing a two-story steel tree. It has two big branches and 19 smaller branches, representing the two teachers and 19 students who died in the shooting. After the ceremony, Javier Cáceres stands in the courtyard on the other side of the windows and brushes away tears while looking up at the tree.
There was a little girl in a dress and just reminded me of my daughter, so it got emotional.
His 9-year-old daughter, Jackie, died in the shooting. Cáceres says seeing the new school is bittersweet.
It is a great school, you know, for these children. You know, sadly, you know, it takes the lives of our children to make this school.
He says he's happy kids are going to enjoy Legacy Elementary for generations. He just wishes Jackie could have been there. The new school was built to keep kids like Jackie safe.
Let's walk through here to the third grade wing. Thank you.
During a tour of the school, Tim Miller points out security features, including bullet-resistant windows.
This would be an example of an access point where if we didn't have a badge, this door would not open.
Miller is executive director of the foundation that raised $60 million to pay for the school's construction.
You'll see cameras throughout the building. There are door prop alarms. So if an exterior door is left open for a little bit of time, the alarm will be sounded.
Door security is a priority. 3 years ago, the shooter entered Robb Elementary through a side door that did not lock automatically the way it should have. Multiple state and federal investigations found that nearly 400 law enforcement officers waited more than an hour to confront the gunman.
I work in the operating room. That's where we had deceased children.
Uvalde School Board President Laura Perez is a nurse at the local hospital.
The survivors, when I hear those children speak, I think, you know, what they saw, what they smelt, what they heard, I mean, that's forever.
She says her hope is that the new school is a new beginning for the students.
We owe it to Edma, to Eva, to the 19 children, right? This is here because of them. So build beautiful memories, tell the stories, and can't wait to hear the laughter in the hallways.
Outside on the playground, the junior high students who survived the shooting are helping break in the swings and merry-go-rounds, letting laughter and chatter fill the space for the first time. Like the song they played during the ceremony, all they and their town can do is keep trying to make today better than the day before.
Hoy como otros días, yo seguiré tratando ser mejor. Y sonriendo haré las cosas con amor.
For NPR News, I'm Camille Phillips in Uvalde.
Buenos días al amor. Buenos días.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Buenos días, señor.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. Take a walk on a haunted trail at Northland Arboretum in Brainerd, October 16th through 18th, from 7 to 9 each evening. Choose from low scare, high scare, or insane high scare options. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the return of their espresso porter filled with roasted coffee flavor. Now on tap and in cans throughout the region. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Armory Arts and Events Center in Park Rapids has an open mic night Thursday, October 16th from 7 to 9. The Beltrami County History Center hosts a panel discussion Saturday, October 18th at 10 a.m. Designing the Future, Women in Engineering. We'll highlight three women who are shaping the region's infrastructure and innovation. United Way of 1000 Lakes presents Dining United, now through November 20th. Find a list of participating Itasca County restaurants at uwlakes.org. Visit the Screamatorium at Chair in downtown Virginia, October 22nd through 25th, and October 29th through November 1st, from 6 to 10 each evening. Those in elementary school must be accompanied by an adult. A tamer version will be offered to younger kids on Halloween from 4 to 6. Great River Rescue in Bemidji has a Halloween walk Saturday, October 25th from 4:30 to 6:30. There'll be costume contests for dogs, photo opportunities, and dogs can play games like bobbing for apples. And the Itasca Curling Association in Grand Rapids offers curling lessons, youth programming, league play, and more. Find more information about upcoming events at itascacurling.com. Now back to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy stepped down from the court in 2018. He's now written a book about his life on the court and off. Kennedy is perhaps best known for his same-sex marriage opinion. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports that the memoir is way more revealing than most books written by justices.
I sat down with Justice Kennedy in his chambers during a week in which TV comic Jimmy Kimmel was suspended and President Trump fired his hand-picked prosecutor for failing to indict former FBI Director James Comey. So I asked the justice what his thoughts were about the current turmoil. While he didn't want to get into what he called political fights, his comments were pointed.
My concern is that we live in an era where reasoned, thoughtful, rational, respectful discourse has been replaced by antagonistic, confrontational conversation. And I'm very worried about it. Democracy is not guaranteed to survive.
And he's also worried about the growth of extreme partisanship in all branches of government, even the court.
My concern is that the court and its own opinions and the way we talk about those who disagree with us has to moderate and become much more respectful.
Though Kennedy, a Reagan appointee, voted most often with the court's conservatives in his 30 years on the court, he was frequently the so-called swing justice whose vote was determinative in controversial cases ranging from free speech and religion to same-sex marriage and abortion. His book reveals more than usual about the personalities on the court and his own internal conflicts. Starting in 1996, Kennedy wrote every major decision about gay rights, culminating in 2015 when he wrote the court's majority opinion declaring that same-sex couples must be allowed to marry everywhere in the country. Here he is reading an excerpt from that opinion.
No union is more profound than marriage. For it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. As some of the petitioners in these cases demonstrate, their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right.
In our conversation, Kennedy said that one of the most persuasive things for him in the case was that there were so many children who'd been adopted by gay parents, but because the law didn't recognize gay marriage, only one person could be the designated legal parent, leaving the other parent unable to sign school papers, make medical decisions, or sometimes even visit a child in the hospital.
This was terribly demeaning to the children. How many children? There were hundreds of thousands of children of gay parents. This was eye-opening for me, and it was very important.
Kennedy's decision in the same-sex marriage case and his decision upholding a woman's right to have an abortion are exhibits A and B of his opposition to originalism, the doctrine that now dominates the Supreme Court. Six members of the current court, including two of his former law clerks, have largely embraced the idea that the Constitution should be interpreted by following its words as understood at the time it was ratified. In contrast, Kennedy says, liberty must be understood over time, and that interpreting the Constitution is not a matter of looking at dictionaries from the 1700s to figure out what the Founding Fathers meant. The men who wrote the Constitution, he says, were cautious enough and modest enough that they intentionally chose capacious terms that would inspire and protect freedom, or, as he put it in his same-sex marriage opinion,
the nature of injustice is that we may not always see it in our own times. The generations that wrote and ratified the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment did not presume to know the extent of freedom in all of its dimensions. And so they entrusted to future generations a charter protecting the right of all persons to enjoy liberty as we learn its meaning.
That is a view that originalists fiercely dispute, at least some of the time, and it was never more apparent than in the same-sex marriage cases, which caused a rupture in Kennedy's relationship with the court's most prominent originalist, Justice Antonin Scalia. The break came over Scalia's dissenting opinion, in which he wrote that if he ever were to join an opinion like Kennedy's, quote, I would hide my head in a bag. Kennedy says that while he was able to shrug off Scalia's dissent, his children and their spouses were devastated by its tone. Indeed, Kennedy says that Scalia, known to all as Nino, seemed to become more isolated at that time, rarely coming to lunch with his colleagues, and he no longer stopped by Kennedy's chambers to chat or debate a point. Months went by, and then one day in February of 2016, Scalia walked down the long corridor of the court to Kennedy's chambers. Once there, he got to the point.
He said the language used in my dissent was intemperate and wrong, and I want to apologize. And I said, nothing is more important to me than our own friendship. And we weren't hugging people, but we gave each other a hug. And I said, Nino, now you've been traveling a lot. You should take better care of yourself. And he said, Tony, he said, this is my last long trip. And that was his final words to me.
About a week later, Scalia died in his sleep while on that trip to Texas. As Kennedy writes in his book, if friendships are slipping away, we must renew them soon, lest times not permit us to celebrate them for long. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, Justice Kennedy talks about his profound internal conflicts over abortion. Coben writes mystery novels and thrillers. His books have sold over 90 million copies. His latest follows a female protagonist from New York to Russia to Dubai. The character actually came from his even more famous co-author.
Harlan would write and he would send me chapters and I would go back in and say, well, I don't think she'd say it like this. I think she'd say it like that. Or, this is amazing. Keep going.
That would be actor, producer, and popular book club leader Reese Witherspoon. Their new book together is Gone Before Goodbye. They explain how they worked together on tomorrow's All Things Considered. And if you aren't by a radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by name. You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. The Hibbing Chamber of Commerce invites kids to Trunk or Treat Saturday, October 25th from noon to 2 at Hibbing City Hall. Adventures and Lifelong Learning continues its fall season every Tuesday at 10 a.m. at the Bemidji Eagles Club. Coffee and treats are served beginning at 9:40. There'll be a variety of speakers each week. Find a full schedule on Facebook. Look for Bemidji Adventures in Lifelong Learning.